All right, we're underway here with the recorder. So let's do a little bit of review. I'd like you to turn to page 40 of your notes, your exegetical outline notes, because I made a slight mistake that I want to correct. I'm entitled Three Mistakes a Year, and again toward the end of the year. All right, on page 40, we saw that Daniel and his three friends were under the death threat because they were part of the Chaldeans, and Nebuchadnezzar had issued a blanket order to kill all the wise men. And so when Daniel learned about that, he got an appointment with Nebuchadnezzar to tell him the dream and the interpretation of the dream. But then he didn't presume on the grace of God, and so he went to prayer. He went to prayer. He included his three friends. Got some prayer partners together. And on point 2, page 40, point A2, the purpose of the group prayer, to plead for the mercies of God. That's why they prayed. Now, I said that word was Hebrew last week. A correction, that word is Aramaic. It is a cognate. You know, I'm just used so much to the Hebrew, but yes, we're in an Aramaic section here. The word is a cognate or a common word with the Hebrew. And so all that I told you about rachamim and parental love and all that is still accurate. But just to be more precise, the word in the text is Aramaic. Oh, did I say that? Oh, okay. Maybe I didn't say it at night. Yeah, there's another senior moment. That's two mistakes in the same day. Yeah. That's right. I will vaporize at the third mistake. Yeah. Yeah, when I make the third mistake and disappear, it will not be the rapture. Yeah, I will be vaporized. Okay. A couple months off. Maybe I'll take November and December off. Okay. All right, so they're pleading for the mercies of God. And on page 41, they receive the revelation. They receive the revelation from God. Now, remember our time frames here. Up on the screen here, I've given you the time frames. We will actually move out of the prophet's present time today, but up until verse 38, we're in the prophet's present time. And the fact that they prayed and God answered their prayer by giving them the revelation really shows us that prayer is important. So we ran through that as an application. We saw that we need to pray at all times, that in Ephesians 6:18, a repetition of that, we need to pray at all times, no matter what. Colossians 4:2, we are to devote ourselves to prayer. In 1 Thessalonians 5:17, we're to pray without ceasing, even on the freeway. Actually, that should say pray without closing your eyes, especially on the freeway. James 1:5, if we lack wisdom, which we definitely need in this world, we're to ask God. And then the main principle in James 5:16, the effective prayer of a righteous man accomplishes much. So we need to strive to live a righteous life. We can't expect God to answer our prayers if we're not living a righteous life. One of those examples I can think of is that husbands are to treat their wives properly so that God will listen to their prayers. All right, so prayer is important. Daniel saw that. Daniel and his friends went to prayer, and God revealed the dream and what the dream signified to him. And then, in the middle of page 41, Daniel broke into another prayer. This was a prayer of praise, and this tells us a lot about God. That he's, first of all, that he's omniscient and omnipotent, and we looked at some parallels throughout Scripture. Up on the screen, 1 Chronicles 29:11, we saw that God is great, he's powerful, he's glorious, he will be victorious, he is majestic, and he has dominion over this world. So that is our God, that is his name, that is his character, all those highlighted words. Job knew that God knew God's character, God's name. He knows that God, he tells us that God is wise and mighty. He has counsel, understanding, strength, and wisdom. That's our God. That's his name there, all the highlighted words. And the response should be the same response as Psalm 113, 1 and 2. We should praise the name of the Lord from this time forth and forever because of who He is and what He does. And Daniel did that. So we looked at the omniscience and omnipotence of God. Then on page 42, the sovereignty of God. See, is this my... All right. In the middle of the page, God is a God of revelation. Let's see, did I... He's the God of revelation who brings darkness to light. And we saw that Jesus picked up that idea and He applied it to Himself, which is an implication of deity. I am the light of the world. And John picks up that theme quite a bit in the book of John and in 1 John. We also saw at the bottom of the page that this verse, Psalm of Daniel 2:22, is considered a messianic verse from the Midrash Rabbah. We saw Rabbi Abba say that this speaks directly of the royal Messiah. And in the Art Scroll Tanakh commentary, we close with the idea that the rabbi said that the coming of the Messiah will be the ultimate proof that the events of history are not haphazard or unconnected. And so that everything is following God's plan, moving down God's course. The world may appear haphazard and unconnected to us, but none of it is. None of it is. Yes?
It's the first time I've seen royal Messiah. Did they think that he's going to come from the line of the kings?
Oh, yes. He's going to come from David's line. Yes. Okay. King Messiah.
They thought he was literally going to be king rather than king.
The Messiah would literally come from the royal family, David's family. Yeah, exactly. That's why they call him the royal Messiah. All righty. Okay, this brings us to page 43. Daniel ends his prayer by praising God in chapter 2, verse 23. So we're in Daniel chapter 2, we're in verse 23, and the prayer is coming to a close. Daniel says, To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you made known to us the king's matter. So he gives thanksgiving to the God of the fathers. And here he's referring to the patriarchs, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God of our fathers, that's a reference to the patriarchs. Very common expression in the Jewish community. And so he very emphatically says, I thank you and praise you. The language is in the emphatic construction. And so he praises God for two benefits. Point B in the middle of the page, for past blessing, which is the reception of wisdom and might. He received that while he was in school. This wisdom and ability that he's been given has elevated Daniel and his three friends to a high point, a high position in the Babylonian government. So that's the past blessing. The present blessing, point C, he answered prayer. God has made known to me, notice that's the singular, to me, Daniel, and to what we, and that's in the plural, referring to his four friends, what we desired of you. So all four were part of the prayer, but one received the revelation, and that's Daniel. So God was responding to all four men. You have made known to us, again, all four, the king's matter. So now Daniel is done praising God, and now it's time to take action. Point four at the bottom of the page, Daniel is going to give testimony before Nebuchadnezzar. He begins with the message to Arioch in verse 24. Point A, the bottom of the page, message to Arioch, verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went in to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, I will declare the interpretation to the king. So point one at the bottom of the page, he makes this strong statement, don't destroy the wise men. Now this may indicate that the killing had not yet begun. As I said, it's possible that the wise men that were in the presence of Nebuchadnezzar met their end immediately. But then the police under Arioch were rounding up the other wise men, including Daniel and his three friends, for a group execution. So that's probably what's going on here. Probably both things happened. So he's pleading on behalf of his pagan peers. He's pleading on their behalf. He's saving their life. And he tells them, I'm ready to come before the king. Page 44. And so Arioch responds very quickly to this request by Daniel, and he presents Daniel. Verse 25. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. Point B1 at the top of page 44. He brings Daniel in haste. And this may indicate that he did not savor the killing of the wise men of his country and the destruction of the school of astrology. You know, he may not have been in favor of this because, you know, this would have destroyed Babylonian culture, wouldn't it? It would have taken a Babylonian culture and totally changed it because these guys were part and parcel of that. And so he may not have liked the order by Nebuchadnezzar, but there's nothing he could do about it because Nebuchadnezzar was the absolute monarch. You know, he would have to mount a coup to get this changed. His life was on the line if he objected. So there wasn't much he could do about it, whether he liked it or not. And he may not have liked it. He may have agreed that Nebuchadnezzar was being a bit hasty and extreme. Point two, notice what he says. I have found a man of the children of the captivity of Judah. I have found a Jewish person. He ambitiously tries to enhance his standing using Daniel. I did it. You know, promotion coming. Look what I found, O king. But you know, he trusts Daniel. Because point three says he will make the interpretation known to the king. So this reveals that Arioch has confidence in Daniel. He understands that Daniel's not a liar. Daniel's not a phony. Daniel's not a flake. You know, Daniel's a righteous man, and he and his three friends have been living righteously in Babylon. Apparently, Arioch had observed this. So he has full confidence in this Jewish man. Who knows? Who knows? Doesn't say anything about that at all. Yes, Karen. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the point. That's the point. Yeah, he must have had confidence in Daniel because he was trying to elevate himself and he was doing a risky thing. Well, I don't think he would do it without confidence. So Arioch was ambitious. All right. So how does Nebuchadnezzar respond? Verse 26. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Okay, remember, both elements are required here. The dream and the interpretation. And if he's able to do both, if he's able to describe the dream, that confirms that he has a supernatural connection of some sort. And then Nebuchadnezzar can trust the interpretation. So Daniel then launches into his testimony starting in verse 27. Point D, D1, the bottom of the page, verse 27. Daniel answered before the king and said, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, or diviners are able to declare it to the king." So you notice point one there. Nobody can do what the king demands. And again, he's acknowledging that this is an unprecedented request, even biblically. Remember that not even Joseph, no one, has been required to reconstruct the dream, and he knows this. And so basically, he's defending the Chaldeans here. He's basically affirming that the Chaldeans were telling you the truth, sir. They weren't stalling, they weren't lying, they were simply powerless. No human being is able to do which the king demands. It's exactly what the Chaldeans said. But he doesn't stop there. You see, the Chaldeans were stumped. Right there, they had to stop. They had to admit they couldn't go any further. They were powerless. But Daniel isn't stumped. He isn't stopped. He moves on in verse 28, page 45, top of the page. He continues, verse 28, first part of the verse. However, very important little word, right? However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. Remember, the Chaldeans said, only the gods know this, and they don't dwell among us. You know, they're stumped. But Daniel says, yes, there is a God. Not a bunch of gods, but there is one God who does provide revelation. So he immediately directs the attention off himself and on to God and the power of God. And he does that by referring to the power of God, point A and B. Only he can reveal secrets, not me, not the Chaldeans, not the idols. He has made known to the king, not me. So notice, Daniel is giving glory to God. He's not taking any credit for himself. He's not like Arioch. He's not saying, I can reveal secrets, and I can make known to the king. So he's giving glory to God, righteous man. Now we come across point C, the term latter days. Very important term, a prophetic term. And you see your notes there. List 13 uses of the term, all in the future, from various different aspects. So we're going to look at a few of those. We won't look at all of them. Let's drop down to number 3, Deuteronomy 4:30. Moses is speaking to the nation in Deuteronomy 4:30, and he says, "When you are in distress and all these things have come upon you," and he's talking about the curses of the covenant, "in the latter days, you will return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice." So this is a prophecy of Israel's return to God at the end of the age. Next one, Deuteronomy 31:29. This is a prophecy of the tribulation period. Again, Moses, "For I know that after my death you will act corruptly and turn from the way which I have commanded you. And evil will befall you when? In the latter days." That evil in the latter days is the tribulation period. For you will do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of your hands. So again, looking all the way down the span of time into the tribulation period. Unfortunately, it also reveals that our history, Jewish history, is not one of obedience. Our history is characterized by disobedience. Now, that's a proof that the Bible is written by God, not by man. If this book was written by Jewish people, we would have said, we're righteous, we're great, you know. And that's what the rabbis do today. But and by the way, Josephus, if you want to read the Bible written by man, read Josephus. In that book, the Jewish community can do nothing wrong. He has an explanation for everything. You know, we do nothing wrong. Well, the Bible, The Word of God says our history, unfortunately, is going to be characterized and is characterized by disobedience. All right, let's drop down to number 6, Jeremiah 30, verse 24. Jeremiah writes, "The fierce anger of the Lord will not turn back until he has performed and until he has accomplished the intent of his heart in the latter days." You will understand this. So we will return to the land in the latter days, and that's when we'll finally get it. That's when we'll finally figure out the Bible. Unfortunately, that's our history. Let's drop down now to number 12. Number 12 toward the bottom of the page, Hosea 3:5. The term is used again, speaking of Israel's return to the land. Hosea writes, "Afterwards the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days." The corollary verse to that is Romans 11:25 through 27, that when the Redeemer returns from comes to Zion, all Israel shall be saved. And finally, very bottom of that list, number 13, we'll look at Micah 4:1. Micah 4:1, this speaks of the kingdom and millennial Mount Zion. Micah 4:1. "It will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised up above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it." And there's an illustration of millennial Mount Zion. We're in the south, looking to the north. This is millennial Mount Zion, protruding up above the other mountains, and millennial Jerusalem on its plateau. And what do we have? We have people from every tribe and tongue and nation streaming up to Mount Zion. So it's a very important term, the latter days or the last days, always speaking of the end of the age. So this revelation goes from Nebuchadnezzar's day clear to the end. It's very eschatological. It'll go to the last days. So it's a broad sweep of time. All right, second part of verse 28, point 3 at the bottom of the page. Second part of verse 28 into verse 29, we look at the cause of the dream. Why in the world did God choose to do this? The human aspect of that is brought out in verse 28, second part. "This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place." So Daniel, God, looking inside of Nebuchadnezzar's mind, has revealed to Daniel what Nebuchadnezzar was thinking. One night, he's going to bed, and he's pondering, what's ahead for me in my empire? And he's anxious about this. He's a typical human being. We always want to know the future, don't we? What's going to happen 2 days from now? What's going to happen to my child who's sick? My grandson who's got this benign brain tumor? We're always anxious about the future, right? Well, Nebuchadnezzar was a very typical human being. What's ahead for me and my empire? So he's anxiously thinking about that. Point B, God, the revealer of secrets, has made known to the king what's going to happen. So God responds to this pagan king's anxiety about the future. So this dream is divine revelation about what will take place, Nebuchadnezzar, in your kingdom. Page 46, verse 30, he continues his explanation. "But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you might understand the thoughts of your mind." Point A. The secret was not revealed to Daniel because of any merit on his part or any skill on his part. He didn't have any unique wisdom above others. He was a human being. But why was it given? Point B, the explanation, that you might know the thoughts of your heart, so that you might understand the future. And I think ultimately to realize who the true God is. So God's responding to this pagan. So what's the dream itself? Point B, the dream is laid out for us in verses 31 through 36. An image makes its appearance in verse 31. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. Now, this is a statue of a man. And this man, this statue, will represent the sweep of human governments that have a major impact upon the Jewish people, starting from Babylon and going all the way to the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. In other words, the times of the Gentiles. From Babylon to the Second Coming. This is what Israel can expect to encounter, and what we can expect to encounter. This is what the world's going to be like. All right, the appearance of the image is described first. You see that it's described as mighty or awesome. The idea there is beautiful. Another good word would be it's a beautiful statue. Part of its beauty is described in the words excellent. And the idea here is that it reflected light. It was dazzling. Now it says, point C says, it stood before you, an erected image. This is a man standing. It's erect. I don't know if that erected is quite the right terminology. It's an erect image. Might be a better way to do it, crossing out the ED at the end there. This is a man standing. He's not prone. He's not kneeling. But he's standing. And finally, the appearance is described as terrible. Other words, other synonyms would be frightening or overpowering or stunning or intense. So this was a beautiful statue. It was dazzling as it reflected the light. It was so beautiful and dazzling that it was so intense that it was frightening and overpowering and stunning. It knocked Nebuchadnezzar's socks off, in other words, if he wore socks to bed. All right, now what is, yes, question?
Why couldn't he remember that?
Oh, he did remember it. Some commentators think he didn't, but my position is I don't see how it would be possible for a man who was jolted out of his sleep with his heart thumping like a jackhammer from an image like this to forget it. No, I don't think he forgot it. And I think he wanted the wise men to describe it accurately. That's what he wanted. You know? No, I don't think. Commentators do, but I don't agree with that. All righty. All right, let's take a look at this image in verses 32 and 33. What is this thing that jolted him awake? Verse 32 and 33. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Well, there's lots of drawings of this image out there. So I have one that I could scan in, so I'm using it here. So these drawings all vary, but we'll all get the general idea from them. First of all, the head of the image is fine gold. Then Daniel moves down the image describing it. Number two, the breast and arms are of silver. So here's the silver part, somewhere, something like this. And notice it has two arms. That'll be significant in just a few minutes. Point three, we move down the image to the belly and thighs, and they're made of brass. So here's the area that Daniel is talking about, the belly and thighs, made of another metal, brass. And finally, we get down to the legs, and that is iron. And notice there's two legs. That'll become important. And as we move down the legs, They change from legs into feet and then eventually into toes. And so the feet and the toes are part iron and part clay. Part iron and part clay. So that's the basic image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. And I have 10:15 on the nose here, so it's time to take your break. We'll pick it up after the break. Listen for the shofar. All right, we're continuing underway there. All righty. We're at the bottom of the page. We've looked at the composition of the image that jolted Nebuchadnezzar awake. And now some observations at the bottom of the page there. First of all, there's a decrease in several areas. This whole vision is non-evolutionary in nature. You know, the world says, mankind's getting better and better and better and better. But that's not exactly God's point of view. There's deterioration in view here. So let's take a look at these decreases. First of all, point A, there's a decrease in the value or the worth of the metals. So here we start on our little image, a deterioration value. We start with fine gold, the most expensive metal. But then as we go down to the base of the statue, silver is less valuable than gold, bronze even less valuable, iron still less valuable, and guess what? At the bottom, we've got worthless clay, basically. So the statue deteriorates from top to bottom. All right, point B. There's a decrease in position from head to foot. The idea here is that the head is the most important and the feet the least important. So we have a deterioration in importance. Again, the head most important, all the way down to the feet. The breast and arms less important, the belly and thighs even less important, the legs still less important, and the feet least important. So the statue is deteriorating from top to bottom. All right, page 47. All right, be patient with this one. Be patient with this one. Deterioration in specific gravity. All right, what are you talking about, Bob? All right, what is specific gravity anyway? Specific gravity is a measure of weight. It's basically the density of a substance as compared to water. For example, a cubic foot of gold is 19 times heavier than a cubic foot of water. Okay? So the specific gravity of gold is 19. Silver, 19 times heavier. You take a cube of water and you take a cube of gold and the gold is 19 times heavier. Okay? And silver, take a cubic foot of silver and a cubic foot of gold, of water, and the silver will be 11 times heavier than the water. Okay? So, this is all laid out for you on the chart there. So I've also put it up on our overhead. Here, the gold has a specific gravity of 19, and as we go down the statue, silver specific gravity is 11, bronze 8.5, iron 7.8. I couldn't find a specific gravity for clay. But what's the idea here? Well, the idea is that the statue is top-heavy and weak on its feet. That's the idea. See this thing? It's ready to topple over. All right? This thing is not secure. Every little earthquake that comes around and it's jiggling. You know, you don't want to be up on the top here of this thing. You don't want to be up there. You know, every wind that blows and this statue is trembling. That's the idea. Yes, very precarious. It's top-heavy. Top-heavy and weak on its feet. So this tells us that these governments are very poorly designed items. They're very, very tenuous. All right. Now, the fact that these kingdoms following Babylon are going to be inferior is point D. Drop down to, you see, statement of fact. Drop down to verse 39 for a second. In verse 39 we read, after you, speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. So this is just a statement of deterioration, very clear statement of deterioration. Now, all this deterioration, point E, is fulfilled in a decrease in the character and authority, the character of authority and rule. In other words, this is going to be fulfilled in the governments that dominate Israel and eventually dominate planet Earth when we get to the end of the cycle here. So we have a deterioration in governmental systems. We begin point E1, Babylon. Babylon was an absolute monarchy, and the monarch was above the law. Okay, this is autocracy. Autocracy is government by one man. Nebuchadnezzar could say or do anything he wanted. Nobody could question him. He could make a decree. He could change a decree. He was in total charge. Government by one sinful man. But then as we move down the statue, we come to point two, Medo-Persia. In the Medo-Persian government, the monarch was not above the law, nor did he have the power to change a decree. This is oligarchy. This is government by a small elite. A small elite. The king is no longer in absolute charge. And we see that in Daniel 6:15. When we get to chapter 6, verse 15, we read this. The king had made a decree. He wanted to change it. But guess what? A small elite comes before the king and they say, then these men came by agreement to the king. There's your small elite. And said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king's powerless to change his statute. And we get to chapter 6. We'll look into all that. But see, notice, a small elite comes to him and he has to obey them. Now what would Nebuchadnezzar have done? He would have said to these guys, off with their heads. You know, off with their heads. We can't, but here, the Medo-Persian king can't do that. Okay?
Of course, he didn't have to institute that law.
Say again?
Under that Medo-Persian
king. Yeah. He didn't have to go along. Yeah, this was the statute developed by Medo-Persia. He was already bound by that. So he's no longer an autocrat. So this is oligarchy, another type of government. Now, third, as we move down, point three, E3 in your outline, we'll come to the Hellenistic Empire, or Greek Empire. Now, under this empire, the leader had no dynastic or royal right to rule. Previous to this, Nebuchadnezzar's son would take over, or the king's son would take over, or somebody from the royal house would be the next ruler. But under the Greek system, a ruler could come to power by force of conquest. He could force his way in, or by personal gifts. In other words, he could persuade people to put him into power. Okay? This is, folks, this is democracy. Democracy began to be formed right about this period in the Greek states. Around 500 B.C., the Greeks began to conceive of democracy, power or rule by the people. Rule by the people, majority rule. And by the Hellenistic Empire, it was in full force. Okay? Then point four, as we move down the statue, we come to Roman imperialism or republicanism. Now, republicanism is government by the people. It's very similar to democracy. Let me back up a second. Democracy is majority rule. Power to the people, majority rule. But republicanism is government by the people, But now we add an emphasis on individual rights. Under democracy, you didn't have individual rights. The majority ruled. If you were not in the majority, tough. You lost out. But under Roman republicanism, it was governed by the people, but if you were not in the majority, you still had some rights and you still had some say. Okay, make sense? That's the difference, the subtle difference between democracy and republican government. Now notice the note here. Roman imperialism or republicanism, which degenerated into mob rule merging with an imperial form of government. All right, so we move down the statue, and now we're going to come to imperialism, which is the first stage of the final empire. And as the legs turn into ankles and feet and toes, the final empire will change into a republican empire. So the final empire actually goes through quite a number of stages. It never disappears. It changes. It changes. And imperialism will dominate stage one. Republicanism will dominate stage two. And we'll see that in a little bit. Okay? So, a summary slide. The center of authority will decrease with each succeeding kingdom from superior, which is Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. He was the autocrat. From his point of view, that's the most superior form of government. From superior down to inferior. And again, from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view, if you gave people power, that was pretty sick, you know. Yeah. Yes. All the material is here in your notes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm just diagramming it here, but the information is right here. Okay? All right, so that's the decrease. The governments will decrease in their quality from superior to inferior. That's why that statue is so shaky. Point two, toward the bottom of the page. Another observation. Question. We will get into this in more detail. I don't know if we'll get into it today, but we will get into it in more detail in a little bit. Okay? So I'm going to ask you to wait. All righty. All right, there's an increase in two areas. So there's a little contrast here. So there's an increase, first of all, point A there, an increase in hardness of the metals. So we start at the top. We have gold, which is really quite soft. You can carve gold. But then as you go down the metal, or down the statue, silver's harder, bronze is harder, iron is harder, and you come down to the feet and you have very hard and very soft material mixed together. So everything looks great till you get to the bottom, right? This whole cycle runs its course.
Excuse me, is that tyranny that's hard over the people which are soft?
No, these are different. This will be explained in a little bit. Okay? Point B, toward the bottom of your page there, there's also an increase in strength. And this is basically military strength. Iron, of course, being the strongest. So we start with gold. Now, Nebuchadnezzar did have a strong military, but he was defeated by the Medo-Persians, and they by the Greeks, and they by the Romans. So the second kingdom is stronger, the third kingdom even stronger. Rome, the final kingdom, is still stronger. But then when we get to the bottom, we have a mixture of very strong military and very weak power. So everything looks great until, again, you get to the feet. All right, this makes sense? So point C, this is fulfilled by in the increase of strength from one empire to another. Basically, when we get to the bottom here, when we get to the bottom of the cycle, Roman republicanism is going to degenerate into anarchy, and the Antichrist is going to try and grab control in that confusion and chaos. That's basically where we're going to go. Hint. Okay, it's going to deteriorate into anarchy. All right, page 48. The dream continues, and a stone makes its appearance in verse 34. You continue to look. looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. All right, the key is that the stone is cut without hands. That tells us it's of divine origin. Mankind has nothing to do with the stone. And then point two, it smashes the image on the feet. And so the smashing of these kingdoms comes in the last stage, comes in the latter days. So here's our image, and I wish I had better graphics, but there comes the stone, wham, on the feet of the image, not the head, not the shoulders, but the feet. And the results, there's two results. We begin with the results on the image, first part of verse 35. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff on the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And so the effect on the image, point 1a, parentheses a there, the whole image is broken to pieces. And then point b, it doesn't just collapse into a heap of rubble. It becomes like chaff. It becomes like dust. And the wind carries it away. And Leopold's comment there, the sweeping away was so complete that the dust found no visible resting place. So you don't even have rubble left. You don't even have dust left when this rock hits the statue. So to dramatize that, there's the effect on the statue. Gone. Just gone. Yes. Well, I'm not worried about that. Okay, the point here is the statue is destroyed, gone. Nothing's left. Nothing's left, not even rubble. Remember that. Now, what's the effect on the stone? What's the effect on the stone? Second part of verse 35. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So point A, the stone becomes a great mountain. So here we go. Here's our stone. It expands in his dream. Expands hugely and it becomes a mountain. And then point B, this mountain fills the whole earth. This is a picture of a worldwide government. It portrays the worldwide scope of the Messianic kingdom. It's the idea here. All right, that's the dream. I've given you some hints as to what it means already. But that's the dream that jolted him awake. What does this thing mean? So point C at the bottom of page 48, we come to the interpretation. Now, verses 36 through 45 present to us the foreordained succession of world powers that are going to dominate Israel from the coming time of Babylon to the coming of the Messiah. In other words, this covers the times of the Gentiles. This is the world powers that are going to affect and dominate Israel until the coming of the Messiah. Now, a lot of empires and a lot of countries are not included in this. You know, Chinese Empire. I don't believe Islam is... Excuse me? Egyptians, yes. There's many world powers that have come and gone, but these are the ones that are going to affect Israel. That's the idea here. The ones that have their major effect upon the Jewish people. All right, we start with the declaration of interpretation, verse 36. This was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. Point A, this is the dream. And you can bet Nebuchadnezzar's affirming that. He's going like this. He's seeing that Daniel's right. So now Nebuchadnezzar can trust the interpretation. Daniel has reconstructed the dream. He says, "We will tell you the interpretation." That plural probably is a reference to Daniel and his three friends. His prayer partners, their role has not been forgotten in this. And they may be present in the background there. Daniel may be in the forefront, nose to nose with the king, and his three friends may just be in the background with Arioch. We don't know. All right, page 49. Let's start to work through this. I Don't know how far we'll get, but that'll leave you eager for more in 2 months when we come back. All right, what is the first empire? It's Babylon. I prefer to refer to it as Babylonian autocracy. So the first empire of the times of the Gentiles is found in verse 37 and 38. Verse 37 and 38. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the air, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. I bet you Nebuchadnezzar liked that one. Yeah. All right, Daniel, I like this. Okay. All right, let's start with our head of gold. There's the head of fine gold. This is Nebuchadnezzar and Babylonian autocracy. Now, point B, the grant to Nebuchadnezzar. There's four qualities are given to Nebuchadnezzar personally. First of all, kingdom. He's given sovereignty over the first empire. He's the king of kings. Secondly, he's given power. He's given the capacity to rule the kingdom. He's given ability to rule. So God gives him the place of authority. Then God gives him the ability. Then third, strength. The idea here is might displayed in coping with the problems of the kingdom. In other words, he was a problem solver. You know, it's not such an easy thing to run an empire, is it? So he has the authority, he has the ability, he's a problem solver. And finally, he's given the glory, he's given the honor and the status of being king of kings. So I think Nebuchadnezzar was a pretty bright guy. I know the question has come up in other classes, was he intelligent? I would say he probably was. He had the ability to rule and solve problems. At least he had the intelligence to surround himself with smart Jewish people. I think that's pretty smart, right? All right, the extent of his rule. Basically, the idea of wheresoever men and animals live, the whole inhabited earth. No limit. So some observations, point D. Nebuchadnezzar was given universal rule. See, the extent was universal, but it lasted only until his time was over. It was universal for a limited period of time. Point two. The fact that he did not proceed to gain the universal rule is beside the point. Two ideas here. First of all, he may have chosen not to extend his empire, or he may not have had enough time. He did take a 7-year vacation. We will look into that, yes. Yes. Okay, so he's given a pretty much carte blanche authority. And he either can choose to use that authority or he will run out of time. So point three, if he so desires, he could have continued to conquer the whole inhabited world with guaranteed success. And you might add there, until his allotted time comes to an end. He could have continued to conquer with guaranteed success until his allotted time came to an end. God puts limits on him. And here is the Middle East. And you can see Babylonia and Babylon and Jerusalem. This was the extent of the Babylonian Empire. That's as far as he got, either through his desire to conquer no more or just because he ran out of time. But that basically is the Babylonian Empire at its greatest extent. Now, all this that we've just stated is affirmed in other prophets. Point 4a, Jeremiah affirms this in Jeremiah 27, 5 through 8. God says, I have made the earth, the men, and the beasts which are on the face of the earth by my great power and by my outstretched arm. And I will give it to the one who is pleasing in my sight. Interesting comment, huh? Now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant. This pagan idol worshiper is really a servant of God. He's under God's control. And I have given him also the wild animals of the field to serve him. All the nations shall serve him and his son and his grandson, note, until the time of his own land comes. Then many nations and great kings will make him their servant. See the time frame limitation? He's got carte blanche until his time comes to an end. Then Babylon becomes the servant of others. It will be that the nation or the kingdom which will not serve him, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and which will not put its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, I will punish that nation with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, declares the Lord, until I have destroyed it by his hand. You see why Jeremiah was saying, submit to the king of Babylon over and over and over again? You know, Jeremiah received revelation from God. Hey, everybody's supposed to submit to this guy. But we wouldn't listen to Jeremiah. And so we reaped the whirlwind. Ezekiel also affirms this in Ezekiel 26, 7 through 14. Point B, we'll just take verse 7. For thus says the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyre from the north Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses, chariots, cavalry, and a great army. So here another nation state comes under his authority, Tyre. But notice what Nebuchadnezzar is called, king of kings. That's his grant. That's his grant. Point E at the bottom of the page, he is the head of gold. He is the head of gold. And point two, there's another affirmation. When we get to chapter 5, we will look at this affirmation as well in chapter 5. Talking about Nebuchadnezzar, O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, majesty to who? To Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Okay, this is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. And whomever he wished, he spared alive. And whomever he wished, he elevated. And whomever he wished, he humbled. He's an autocrat. He is one man, one sinful man, ruled by one sinful man. Okay? Am I going to get through page 50? All right, we'll try the second kingdom. Or do you guys want to go early? I got a couple of minutes left. Keep going? All right, keep going. Page 50, we change our time frame now. We move into verse 39, and we now move to the near future, to the Persian period. Verse 39, first part of the verse, moves us ahead in time to the second empire, which is Medo-Persia. First part of verse 39. After you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. Now notice, not merely after Nebuchadnezzar, but after the Babylonian Empire. We're not talking simply about a man here, a king. We're talking about a kingdom. The Babylonian kingdom and now the Medo-Persian Empire. All right, so here is our statue. Nebuchadnezzar is the autocrat, the head of gold. After him, the breast and silver, breast and arms made of silver. This represents Medo-Persian oligarchy. Now, point B, it's inferior to Babylon. How? That's its status, but how would it be inferior? Well, there are four possible thoughts, four possible reasons. Number one, it might be that God considers it inferior in influence and achievement, since the roots of the Babylonian Empire originated soon after the flood in Genesis 10 or 11. The idea here is that the Medo-Persian Empire doesn't go back that far in human history. And Babylon began its influence way back in Genesis 10. Or it might be inferior because it lacked inner unity. The inner unity of Babylon, because the Medes and the Persians, although they were united, never fused into one people. And that's the point of the two arms here on our statue. Medes and the Persians, two key but separate elements in this country, in this empire. Thirdly, some commentators think it lacked ecumenicity or tolerance of diverse elements. But number four is probably the best option. Maybe all four of them are included, but number four is probably the best option. It's an inferior in its type of government, in that the leader was not above the mistakes of the law. And again, we'll see that in chapter 6. The king was subject to the law. He was subject to the ruling elite. So again, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, this would be a decrease in quality. Okay, so this is oligarchy. Rule by a small elite. And here is the Persian Empire. Now, the Persian Empire was not inferior in size to Babylon. It was bigger than Babylon. You see, Babylon took this area here. The Medo-Persian Empire was a bit bigger. But it, so it wasn't inferior in size, but it was in quality, in the quality of its government. Up here, this is Greece and Macedonia up here. Okay. They tried to penetrate in, didn't get very far. And then Alexander the Great will give them a kick out. Okay. All righty. Yeah, that's a pretty big empire. All righty. That brings us to a close for today. We'll pick it up in 2 months. We'll pick it up in January on page 51. Pick it up on page 51. Let me go ahead and close. Let me go ahead and close in prayer. All righty. Now, the encouraging thing to me about all this stuff is we know where the world's going, you guys. And when we get through this whole cycle, you'll see that everything is under control. Everything's under control. All right, can I get your attention quickly here? Father, again, I want to thank you for your word. That's quite an amazing book we're looking at, and an amazing revelation to Nebuchadnezzar and then explained through Daniel. But Lord, as I've just said, to me it's very encouraging because we will see that everything is going according to your plan. And we look forward to the time when the Messianic kingdom comes and the superior government comes, not government by man in any way, shape, or form, but government by God. Theocracy, government by our blessed and loving and powerful and righteous and perfect Messiah. That's what we're built for, Lord. And help us to anticipate this as we look at the times of the Gentiles. So I do ask that you bring us back in a couple of months, eager to continue our study in Daniel and encouraged by all that we have looked at so far. So I lift us up to you with that request in Jesus' name. Amen. All righty, Karen.